Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday morning. Beautiful day here in Phoenix, Arizona. And hopefully it's a nice day where you are. Someone up in Canada, one of our good Canadian listeners, informed me just a little while ago, and we do believe that she is Canadian, that we should expect cool weather. And I should bring some of my sweaters along. So I think that what that means is she was saying I should bring my coogies with me for the cruise. And I think she was requesting that I wear them during the teaching sessions. I think that's what she was requesting. At least we're going to say that she did, and then get to blame her when I do.
I think you should take into account that your students need to be able to concentrate on what you're saying.
Yes. Well, you know what? When you have to overcome small difficulties to concentrate, it just makes it all the more special for you. So
this is no small difficulty.
Hey, remember, one of the class sessions, I've been looking at the schedule. That's real good, trying to drink coffee with the microphone thing there. That's good. I was looking at the class schedules, and on formal night, there's one formal night because it's a short cruise. Is that the schedule right there? Well, look at the schedule. No, that's the schedule for the debate, isn't it? That's the actual. Well, I can't see that from here. What are you talking about? I mean, I had LASIK, but that's small print, dude.
No, I got the events schedule here, October 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th.
Yeah, which 19th. Does it say formal night somewhere on that?
Yes, it does.
That should be, I think, the 15th. Probably the second night. Probably wouldn't be the third night. Could be, I suppose. There's only one of them.
No, this is October 16th, the third. Well, we cruise on the 15th, so technically that is the second night.
Right, right. So, yes. And so that's formal night. And our class goes to within, like, we basically go straight from the class to dinner. We have early dinner, which is nice. I like having the evening. I like having dinner early. But we go straight to dinner from class.
So we've got 8 to 9:30 a.m. session 3, and then session 4 is at 3:30 to
5.
Well, it doesn't actually say when it would
Yeah, but dinner starts at 5:30.
Theoretically, yes. And then 5:30 is the formal group photograph.
Uh-huh. So we're not going to, in other words, we're not going to have time to get changed between the class and the photo and formal dinner. So what that means is we come nuffed. For the ladies especially, we just have to skip the class at all. So what does that mean? That means you come to the class in your formal wear, which means I will be coming to class in my formal wear. And you know what that is. Hello?
No, I'm afraid to ask.
You don't know? Haven't you seen the pictures in my office?
Okay, it'll come to me eventually if I don't just go back in and look. But
man, wow! I think you just messed up your microphone again. Probably crashed the entire thing. The system's probably going down right now, even
no,
as we
it's
mentioned.
Not. It's still clicking along.
Okay, so
I believe that there is a kilt involved.
Aye, laddie. So all those folks who take that class, they're going to get, we're going to have Scottish theology on that afternoon. Yes, we are.
Okay. If we have to put up with the kilt, that's one thing. The kilt and
the
accent.
Oh, it goes together beautifully.
Over the top.
It's a shame I can't bring my claymore. I don't think they'll allow it on the plane or on the ship.
I guarantee you it wouldn't allow it on the ship either or in the hotel. I can just see you walking into the hotel with a kilt and the sword.
I just got here from the Highlands. Yes, indeed. All right. And don't even bother forwarding all the emails we're going to get mocking me. I don't want to see them. I don't care. Once you get to my age.
I can see it now. Yes, I'd like to check in for my flight. Where would you say we put this?
It's a little over 4 inches, which doesn't matter anymore anyways. But
Dr. White, do you know what the do not fly list is? You've just been put on.
There you go. Anyway, so looking forward to that. That's gonna be enjoyable. But yeah, we gotta do it. There's just not enough time for anybody to get changed at that particular point. So one of those classes will all be looking pretty spiffy as far as that goes. And I got a new tablet writing device for this laptop because I'm gonna be taking this one. It's nice and big and fast and stuff like that. So looking forward to that, and it's coming up way faster than it should be right now. That's for sure. let's see. I'm just watching the odd conversations going on channel, people wondering what in the world we're doing. But I can't believe it took you that long to figure that one out, Rich. That was pretty sad. So anyway, 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341 if you would like to participate, not if you'd like to waste all of our program being obtuse and acting like somebody you're not. But otherwise, for everybody else, 877-753-3341. And as you know, the gentleman I will be debating at the end of the cruise is a gentleman by the name of Shabir Ali. We have been, it's been a while since we did this, but we've been listening to a debate between Shabir Ali and Mike Lycona. And we are into the cross-examination period, and I figured since we're getting close to the debate, we might want to finish this up because it's all on the same subject. And so those of you who will be attending the debate, and I hope that especially if you're up in the Seattle area, or if, it's a Friday night, so even if it's a long drive, reserve a room at the SeaTac Marriott and come up and be there for that evening. It's going to be a wonderful time. And let's face it, this doesn't happen very often in the United States anymore. You don't. In fact, this kind of debate doesn't happen very often anywhere in the world. I mean, we are in one of the last nations in the world where you could even have this kind of a debate. Either because obviously in Islamic countries it wouldn't be allowed because I wouldn't live long enough to do it, or wouldn't be allowed in to do this kind of debate. In Western countries, we are self-destructing and passing laws against quote-unquote hate speech, which can then be used to, stifle all free speech and all dialogue. And last year at the Biola debate, the moderator made a very good comment. He said, if we don't argue our positions, we'll end up fighting. And I thought that was a good insight, that if you stifle the expression of difference and the dialogue that takes place, then the only thing you can do is fight each other. And that leads to violence rather than disagreement and discussion and dialogue. And so it's a might be a long drive for some of you. But hey, if you split up two different directions, stay the night, because obviously the debate's going to go late. Stay there at the hotel that evening, and then head back the next day. The next day is Saturday. It's not a Saturday night debate. It's a Friday night debate, so it would work out really well. So I'd encourage some of you, if you're within driving distance, come on up, be with us. We could use the support, and give consideration to that. And along those lines, we'll pick up, believe it or not, I do know where we were in this debate, even though it's probably been a month since we played it last, but I do keep notes on my system here. And let's continue with the it wasn't cross-examination. That was the one thing about this debate. It was conversation. It was so nice, and all that stuff. And I'd just rather have a real, real debate.
No, I'm not speaking of rescue here as rescue prior to death. What I'm saying is that the earliest belief in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, as we can tell from the earliest sources, is that despite the fact that everyone had seen Jesus dying on the cross, God had somehow rescued Jesus and raised him to himself, so that Peter can proclaim in the Acts of the Apostles that death could not hold him. And of course, because God was with him, rescuing him, raising him from the dead, you can put it that way if you want.
if you want. I don't think so, in the sense that Surah 4:157 clearly states they did not crucify him, they did not kill him. Those two have to go together, and I'm going to be very interested to see how consistent Shabir is on this point, because I've heard a number of his discussions where he's left open the possibility that Jesus was crucified, but that he just didn't die, that he was rescued by God, he was raised up to his presence. And we're going to have to possibly have a little discussion as to what raised up means, even though obviously the focus for me is going to be upon the positive defense of the crucifixion. From my perspective, obviously, the only reason that someone like Shabir Ali denies the crucifixion is because of his Islamic beliefs. And if you recall, when we first started this, at the opening, Shabir basically admitted that. He admitted that he has a prejudice from his Islamic perspective that does impact his reading of the historical sources.
You mentioned the speech of Peter, which we are now referring to.
So you did say the earliest strata talks about Jesus being raised from the dead. Do you grant that?
The earliest strata. Well, we should first listen to the words, and then we'll talk about the interpretation.
He did say that. In fact, I was just sitting here listening to him stating that he was rescued, and he interpreted the early church's message of being resurrected from the dead as being rescued. That's not the same thing as what the Quran's talking about, and that's why Mike Lycona is jumping on that as well he needs to, because that seemed to be an inconsistency at this point.
Because there's something to be said about that. The passage which Peter is citing in the Acts of the Apostles is from the Psalms, Psalm 16. Read the commentary on Psalm 16. The New Jerusalem Bible, in its footnoting on that psalm, says that this actually refers to a person who has had a close brush with death.
Now, I've heard Jamal Badawi say the same thing here, and that is when, in essence, and listening to, we've played some of Badawi's materials before, in essence, what they do is they go back to these psalms and they argue that the New Testament is misrepresenting every one of these psalms on the basis of the idea. And I know I've explained this, but not everyone listens to every single program other than Algo, who memorizes every program we do and what day it was done and what I was wearing that day. And he just scares me to death. But other than him, need to repeat some of these things sometimes because we get new listeners, thankfully. And hopefully you invite folks to listen in and stuff like that. That's how we get the word out. But anyway, the idea is, from their perspective, that everything in the psalm has to have a direct relationship to Jesus, or there can be connection at all. So the idea of prophecy, where a portion of a psalm is relevant but not all of it, is dismissed by Jamal Badawi and hence by Shabir Ali as well. And so he's going back here to Psalm 16, and here is a psalmist who had a close brush with death. Well, duh! He obviously didn't die, or he couldn't have written the psalm. And so if you think about the application of this mindset, there could not be a prophecy about resurrection, because whoever wrote any of the psalms would have to have themselves been resurrected for their life experience to have that kind of a parallel. See? Which ignores the fact that the uniqueness of Jesus' ministry would transcend any of the individual portions of prophecy that would be recorded in the Psalms or anybody or any place else in regards to the entirety of his ministry.
The psalm does not actually necessitate the person physically dying. So now, to say that God raised this person from the dead does not necessarily, in the ancient world, require that the person had to be physically actually dead. You see, our conception of what involves death or what means death has changed over time. You mentioned previously N.T. Wright and his excellent book, This Thick, on the resurrection of the Son of God. If you read it throughout, you will see he mentions some of the conceptions that were there and some of which you refer to, but he also mentions the story Kalerho. In the story, Kalerho is beaten by her husband and she apparently dies. And she is buried, but some grave robbers come and they are surprised to find her alive. They are scared off and Kalerho survives. And then, according to the story, as cited by N.T. Wright, she says, "I was dead and I came back to life." Even though we know from the story that she was not dead. But this is how people might refer to things. If a guy is diagnosed with death today, he's kept in a morgue, he's watched for a little bit, And in fact, he doesn't actually die. He might say, I came back from the dead, but we know he wasn't actually dead. Today, our conception of death has actually improved because we have put a person through an EEG, through an ECG. There are certain grimacing effects that we test for, five of them, that are noted by Constance Jones in his book, The Complete Book of Death and Dying. And after all of these tests, we keep a person to just watch him, just to make absolutely sure. So it is possible that a person might appear to be dead in the ancient world, and that he wasn't actually dead. But if that person survived, one would say that he actually came back from the dead. Documentation for this is found in an excellent book by Jan Bondesen. His book is entitled Buried Alive. A terrifying history of our most primal fear. And what he has shown here is that throughout history, there have been difficulties identifying when exactly is a person finally dead. And he showed in particular, in the time of Jesus, though that Jesus was not his particular concern, he is just simply going through the whole sweep of history. What he has shown is that in that time, people could not determine when a person actually had died. And in that same book, we have a quotation, this other book here, we have a quotation from one of the Jewish Talmud sources, which might help us to understand why the women, disciples of Jesus, went to the tomb. Listen to it. It says, the Babylonian Talmud stipulates, one should go out to the cemetery and check on the dead 3 days after the funeral, and one should not fear that by doing so he follows a Gentile practice. It happened that a checkup after 3 days discovered that a certain person was buried alive. This person lived for another 25 years, had sons, and then died. And the reference is here. They've actually given the reference. So if you ask me now, it is there.
Okay.
So,
yeah, but the Talmud, can I?
Now, before Mike responds to all this, you'll notice a couple things. What Shabir is doing here is he is weaving a tapestry of doubt that, in essence, in the old world, there you just couldn't tell when somebody was dead. Really? I think there were a number of instances when you could tell when someone was dead. Someone who was decapitated would be dead. Someone who had a sword run through them and there was blood everywhere and they're not breathing and they're not breathing for quite some time. They're dead. And remember, while the Jews might have mistook in one instance, and so what you're doing here is you're digging around to try to find one instance of this happening. What are the parallels between those instances and the death of Jesus? Were these public executions done by Romans? Probably the best folks in the ancient world at killing people were Romans. And they generally made sure that they really did kill their victims. And notice that's why, for example, you had the practice of breaking the legs of those who were upon a cross. The idea being that as long as your legs were functioning and you still had any strength at all, you could once in a while push yourself up enough to get some oxygen into your lungs to try to breathe. And once you broke the legs and the pain would be too great, you couldn't push up on the legs anymore. And then you would suffocate and die in a horrible way. They don't do this with Jesus because why? Because they recognize that he's already dead. He's not pushing against his legs to get any breath. And this has been going on for quite some time. And obviously, just think for a moment of trying to mask breathing while you're on a cross, trying to hold your breath so that when your ribs are exposed like that. It's one thing under clothing. They don't have any clothes on, folks. All the pictures are just a little bit too nice about that. This was meant to be a degrading way of dying. And so there's no way to parallel these other instances with a public crucifixion by the Romans that involves scourging. It involved nailing of the limbs to planks of wood that would cause a tremendous amount of bleeding, and then a spear in the side. Now, Shabir is going to ignore the spear. Because it's in John, and if it's in John, he can just dismiss it, just throws it out, and it's not relevant. But you're still left with this idea that Roman guards who have killed, some of these men would have killed tens and dozens and maybe hundreds of people. Remember, Josephus records for us some of the mass executions and crucifixions that took place outside of Jerusalem. These individuals know what they're doing. and they know how to kill somebody, and it's going to come back on them if they fail. So that the chances of them being too kind to a condemned criminal aren't overly good, okay? And so to take a situation where maybe someone had a, you know, cardiac arrest or congestive heart failure or something like that, they're clothed and they're mistaken as having died, with a public execution by the Romans, by crucifixion, is a reach that can only be explained by the overriding religious commitment to Surah 4:157. That's the only reason. That's the only thing you can come up with in trying to drag these kinds of things out of history, to come up with some mechanism of saying, well, it's possible, it's a maybe. And if someone utilized the same kinds of arguments to argue against Muhammad and to argue against the miracle, I guess, singular, of Muhammad and his night flight and things like that, Shabir would never accept any of it. If you had to dig that far and go to that extent, he wouldn't accept any of that kind of argumentation. But when it comes to the very heart of the Christian message that all of the meaningful first century sources testify was the very essence of the message of Christianity, well, he still accepts the, well, maybe it's possible, it could have been type of an argument.
You respond to some of this, because you're giving me a whole lot here.
Okay, we've shifted into the next quarter of the last quarter hour.
Okay.
We'll be going to you for some questions in about 12 minutes.
The Talmud is late. It's several hundred years after Jesus. So just because the Talmud mentions that in its day, when it was reporting this stuff, which could have been 300-400 years after Christ, that was the way things were done, that doesn't mean that that's the way it was done in Jesus' day. In fact, you mentioned about how we can't be certain a person's dead, well, because we don't have EEGs. I really don't think that they would have had much doubt that John the Baptist was dead, who had been beheaded.
Yes.
So, now, even with this thing, with the Talmud, they may have gone to the tomb to check it out to see if the person...
But you see, Mike, that is exactly my point. You see, once a person is beheaded, you're mm-hmm. sure he's dead. But you put a person on a cross, you expect that after 3 days, through exhaustion and facing the elements and even the vultures, who might come and pluck out your eye, then by 3 days' time, you will be dead. But then, if you take him down after a few hours, even Pilate wonders, are you sure he's dead? But of course, Pilate has an interest in preserving Jesus because he didn't want Jesus crucified in the first place.
Now, let's address that. Again, if you dismiss the New Testament text in its own testimony, which Shabir does, that Jesus gave up his spirit. And so, you know, he just dismisses that. That can't be true. Even though, ironically, I was thinking this morning, the Quran specifically states that revelation was taking place, that the Injil was given to Jesus, that revelation took place within that context. Evidently, we don't know any longer what that was. And even though the Quran seemingly believes that the Torah, given 2,000 years earlier than Muhammad, was still in such a state that you could challenge someone to produce something even like the Torah, which would make no sense if it had already been corrupted. But all those issues aside, he dismisses the New Testament's own teaching that Jesus gave up his spirit, and that he would have done so not 3 days down the road, but that there is a purposeful timing here in regards to the fulfillment of prophecy, so on and so forth. So he dismisses that and says, yeah, of course, if he had been beheaded, then there wouldn't be any questions here. But and then he talks about Pilate. Now, Pilate somehow wants to protect Jesus. Is that why he turns him over to be crucified? In fact, once he has given in to Jewish leaders, Pilate has absolutely no purpose in protecting Jesus. In fact, just the opposite is now the case. He would have a mess on his hands if he does not follow through in the crucifixion of Jesus. Because why did Pilate eventually give in? What was it? What was the statement that finally makes Pilate go, even though he said, I don't find any guilt in him? We have no king but Caesar. The implicit assertion was, hey, look, and we already know Pilate was having problems with Rome anyways. So all the last thing in the world he needs is for these Jews, and we know from the stories of Paul, they will go to the farthest lengths to pursue their purposes, as they did in pursuing Paul all the way to Rome. Last thing he needs is these zealous Jews sending off letters to Rome saying, hey, Pilate's out here, and we've got a false Messiah guy claiming to be the king of the Jews, and he won't do anything about him. He just scourged him, let him go free. And he's leading the people astray, and he's weak. And we pointed out that this man is putting himself up against Caesar, and he's fomenting rebellion against Caesar, and blah, 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 blah. That's the last thing that he wants, is for that to happen. And so the idea that Pilate would have some reason to try to protect Jesus at this point is ridiculous. Now, it is a good point that Pilate goes, is he dead already? But that just simply reflects, again, that Jesus gave up his spirit. He was the one in charge of this situation, which, again, ironically, from a worldview perspective, Shabir should have no problem with. Should have no problem with at all. I mean, even from an Islamic perspective, Jesus is virgin-born. He works miracles. So the idea that he would have the capacity and ability to give up his spirit when his work is done is completely consistent with what his own Islamic beliefs about Jesus would be. But at this point, he abandons his Islamic beliefs, doesn't pull anything out of the Hadith or anything at all that's supported from the earliest centuries of Islamic belief. And instead, what he does, he goes to John Dominic Cross and Marcus Borg. He goes to the Jesus seminar for folks, and well, you know, clearly these are stories that developed over time, and blah 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 blah. And just complete inconsistency at this point. Can't even hold these things together in any way. So Pilate, the last thing, once Jesus is nailed on the cross, the last thing that Pilate could ever want would be for that crucifixion to quote unquote fail. That'd be the last thing. And so I see no reason to go that direction.
So I think if you make it your job to prove that Jesus resurrected from the dead, you actually have a difficult job. If you say that Jesus rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, Muslims and Christians can both believe that without having to prove it. Look, Jesus...
Except, that's said too quickly. What the Muslim means by Jesus ascending into heaven, that term from Surah 4, 158. First of all, Muslims don't agree as to what that means. We've talked about this before on the program. They don't know. Does that mean that this happened in the garden? I mean, at one point, I've heard Shabir suggest that because he talks about the Biblical Archaeology Review article that talked about the wine press cave in Gethsemane and that it had a hole in the center and maybe he went up through the hole. So that would be before, you know, that would support the substitution idea and somebody else was made to look like Jesus. Maybe it was Judas. Maybe it was a Roman soldier, whatever. Was it then? Was it after the scourging and before the crucifixion so that Simon the Cyrene is made to look like Jesus? That's another theory that's been given. Are we going to take a swoon theory idea here and after he leaves the grave, he's taken up to heaven? Does he go someplace else for a while, as people in India believe, and start a whole new religion over there, and then he's taken up? We don't know, because despite the fact that the Quran calls itself a clear and perspicuous book, especially when it comes to Surah 4, 157, it ain't. That text just doesn't answer the questions, and Shabir knows this, which is why he has very frequently himself pointed out the fact. There are options. There are other ways that can be understood. And that's what he's doing in this debate, is saying, hey, we allow for options. You guys have painted yourself into the corner with this idea that Jesus had to die and he had to be raised from the dead on the third day, or there's no Christianity, et cetera, et cetera, which at that point is exactly the case. That is exactly the corner, quote unquote, we've been painted into by the apostolic proclamation of the first century itself. That is what Christianity teaches, no question about it.
This was one of the greatest persons who walked the earth in all of history. He was a great teacher. We remember him for his memorable sayings, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule is something that people wish to have in every religion, and we find parallels for that in other religions through searching. But it's such a known teaching of Jesus. Such beautiful teachings from a man, the miraculous works that Muslims and Christians believe that he performed, the fact that he was born of a virgin, that he raised the dead back to life, that he cured the leper, that he healed the blind. Muslims and Christians believe that. We do not need to prove it to the world, but by making it your job that you have to prove that Jesus resurrected from the dead, and you have said that if you cannot prove this, then it would make Christianity appear to be false. You have hinged everything on this.
If it was proved, disproved, if Christ has not been raised, then the person's faith is worthless. The burden of proof, I don't have to as a Christian. Most Christians aren't Christians because they prove Jesus rose from the dead, but they still believe it. May I comment on Pilate real quick? You mentioned there how Pilate, that he wanted to save Jesus. I guess I have two comments. You've exerted a lot of time and effort this evening undermining the Gospels, and so I'm bewildered that now you would appeal to those very texts in order to prove your point.
Because I've told you previously, I'm not saying that all of the Gospels are false. What I'm saying is that there has been an evolution among the Gospels. And in peeling back the layers of evolution, Mike, you have not touched on that at all.
The evolution of the Gospels. Remember the question that I asked, Shabir. Okay, give us a mechanism whereby we can detect what is inspired in the Gospels and what is not inspired in the Gospels. And what was his methodology? If it agrees to the Quran, it's inspired. If it doesn't, then it wasn't. So, obviously, from Shabir's perspective, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all polluted by Paul. He blames Paul for everything. And so the original followers of Jesus evidently didn't write anything, or if they did, somehow these mean, terrible, horrible, nasty Pauline people wiped out everything they wrote. Or maybe it ended up in the Gospel of Thomas somewhere, or something like that, in the second century, which again is a dead-end road if you want to try to go down that direction. The inconsistency remains clear. It's forced upon the Muslim by a 7th century statement in one verse of the Quran that goes against all the historical record at that point. It's just that we see it over and over again.
I have not spoken anything about the evolution of the Gospels.
I'm on this other hill. I presented evidence that's decades earlier. I'm still waiting for you to attack this hill. Now, the thing about Pilate, you said, okay, now Pilate wanted to rescue Jesus here. He didn't want to crucify him. And this is another thing I'm kind of surprised at, because critical scholars normally regard this as political propaganda by the early Christians and that it's not historical, whereas these same scholars accept the death of Jesus because it's so much more, it's so much more better attested. So if you're going to accept the Pilate story, then all the more you should accept the story of Jesus' death, because there's much more going for it.
Now, you know, Mike Licona is right at that point. Obviously, those who adopt the fundamental methodology that Shabir adopts in dealing with the Gospels, that is, who cut it up into pieces and accept this, reject that, whatever they want to do based upon some theory that they come up with as to what the actual intentions of the redactors were and late dating and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. If he would be consistent at that point, then he really can't do this pick and choose stuff that he does with the New Testament, where he can grab something and he'll quote it and it's authoritative when it's about Pilate not wanting to kill Jesus. But if there is anything later about Pilate or before about Pilate that is against what his theories are, he can just dismiss that as political propaganda or whatever else it might be. The inconsistent use of sources is something that from the very first time I played anything by Shabir Ali on this program to this day, I have repeated that very statement over and over and over again, is that the inconsistency of his use of sources is the clearest demonstration of the fact that his arguments are invalid. 877-753-3341 still is the phone number if you want to be involved in the program today. 877-753-3341.
If you reject the Jesus death, then all the more you should reject the Pilate, because there's less going for it.
Now, you see, I think your point here is built on what we might call epistemological confusion. There is a way in which we learn things. I didn't mean to be funny about that. I'm just trying to put my thoughts together, and, you know, we have to be quick. You see, we start with certain basic assumptions. So basic assumption, I'm a Muslim.
Therefore, I believe that the Quran is the word of God. Therefore, I believe the Quran's depiction that God raised Jesus to himself and that his enemies did not kill him. And this might be explained in a variety of ways. Jeffrey Parinder, a Christian writer in his book Jesus and the Quran, says that perhaps this actually means that the Jews didn't kill him because the Romans did. Or perhaps it means that whereas they thought they killed him, they hadn't actually killed him, and it was God who killed him. And many verses of the Quran can be cited in collusion with this to show that the Quran has this outlook, that it's not the enemy that kills the righteous person of God. It is God who takes the life of the person.
And he's right. You can read it that way. And given the lack of commentary in the early centuries of Islam on this, which has to be such a key element. I mean, when Muhammad denies the Trinity, he does so more than once, and he talks about it at length, and it's, you can find this mentioned in the hadith. But this one verse just goes by silently. And yet once there is the conflict, once the borders of Islam are established, and now you have the give and take with Christians, all of a sudden the Arabs have to start going, this is really a major contradiction and denial of what Christians believe, and so now you start hearing it discussed. But up till then, you don't hear it being discussed. And it really does make a person wonder, is the majority reading of Surah 4, 1-7, the most obvious reading of it? Well, don't get me wrong. I certainly understand exactly why the majority understands Surah 4, 1-7 the way that they do. Just last night, my Arabic tutor was here at the office, and we actually spent some time in that particular text. We're going to spend some more time in it next week before I head up for the conference and the cruise and the debate. And we were talking about, I was asking questions about the form of the verb, and it's in the passive. It was made to appear to them. And who's doing the action of the verb, and what are some of the other possible meanings of this particular verb? And we were, you know, taking it apart on that level. And the fact is, that particular ayah simply doesn't have enough specificity in it to answer the massive weight of questions that has to come crashing down upon it, given that it is the primary reason why a major world religion basically has changed history. You want to know a good parallel? I just thought of this. This is a good parallel to the whole situation of Surah 4, 157. There's another religion that likewise has to change history. And that's the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society has taught, now they're changing this, now they're changing their own history. They've had to change secular history, that didn't work too well. So now they're having to change their own history. But they have taught for quite some time now that the final generation would die, that Armageddon would take place before the final generation that saw the events of 1914 passes away. Well, that generation, on any meaningful level, already has, but they're trying to stretch out for all they can, but they're slowly getting rid of this 1914 prophecy. They based that initially upon a completely fallacious reading of Daniel and the cutting down the tree and seven times 360, 2,520 years from the fall of Jerusalem is 1914. Well, it's not. And so what they did is, we know when Jerusalem fell. I remember very, very clearly in my Old Testament introduction class that Dr. D.C. Martin told us that there were certain dates that we had to remember for that particular class. And one of those dates was when Jerusalem fell, which was 586/7. Why 586/7? Because we just don't know? No, because they didn't go January to December. The Babylonians and the Jews both had different reckoning, one starting the spring, one starting the fall. In other words, ancient peoples began their years at different points, not just necessarily January 1st to December 31st. So what that means then is that 586/587 is taking into consideration the whole year as it was understood by those ancient countries. Now, that was one of the dates that I had to memorize, that I had to know when Jerusalem fell. It fell to Nebuchadnezzar in the 19th regnal year, the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, which some might consider the 20th because there was an ascension year. There was a year at the beginning that wasn't actually counted because of all the festivities and stuff like that, and then it would start from there. Anyway, to make a long story short, what the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society had to do is they had to change when Jerusalem fell to fit their prophecy. They had to change history to make it fit the 1914 thing. They had to move it back to 607. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was not even king at that point in time. So how did they establish their argument? The only way they did so, if you can go back to the old light pale blue Aid to Bible Understanding book, what they did is they just attacked every bit of information that establishes the chronology of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Now, for a lot of folks, as long as you attack that stuff, that's enough to establish another claim. And most folks won't stop and think and go, well, just attacking that doesn't mean you're actually establishing your own position, does it? But that's what they did. And one of the reasons we know this, aside from we know secular history and know that there's no possible way that their date is correct, I mean, we have cuneiform tablets, okay? Talk about writing something in stone. These things were written in stone. You would have to have had a massive conspiracy extending over 200 years and hundreds of thousands of square miles where everybody changed all of written history on stones, carving in stones, and buried them for some reason to come up with the Watchtower theory. It's just not possible. But that's what they did. They attacked it in that fashion. That's what Shabir Ali is doing here. He's got his preconception. The Jehovah's Witness has been taught by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, his ultimate authority, that 1914 is the date. And that the prophecy of Daniel, 2,520 years, okay, he's got to make that fit. So you attack everything in history that goes against your religious theory. And Shabir Ali has Surah 4:157. It's 600 years removed from the actual events, but what you got to do is to establish that, then you attack all the historical documentation, all the historical data that clearly demonstrates that Jesus Christ was crucified upon a cross under Pontius Pilate in the beginning of the fourth decade of the first century. It's right there. That's the only way you can establish it. Direct parallel. You want another parallel? Mormonism. Mormonism has the Book of Mormon, and so what do you do with ancient Mesoamerican archaeology? You turn it into the story of the Nephites and Lamanites. And if you can't find any evidence of the Nephites and Lamanites, even though you've dragged everybody from BYU down there for the past 50 years and showed them the Nephite, the Toltecs and Olmecs and Mayans and turned them into Nephites and Lamanites who are speaking Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics and running around in chariots with bows and arrows and swords and things like that, which none of the people back there were doing. But anyway, then what you do is you attack that, and when that doesn't work, now what you do is you say that the story of the Book of Mormon took place in such a small little space that we'll never really find any of the actual remains of the maybe 40 square miles, and we're just not going to be able to dig up enough of the jungle to find out where this actually took place, and blah, 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 which clearly is not what Joseph Smith taught, because he was finding Lamanites and Nephites all the way across toward Missouri someplace. So that doesn't work. So, but you change history. You attack that which contradicts what your ultimate religious authority says actually ended up taking place. And that's what Shabir Ali is doing here. He won't do that when it comes to the Quran. He won't do that when it comes to Muhammad. But he will do that when it comes to the New Testament.
Moreover, it could mean that even though they had actually physically killed him, he is still alive with God. And the Quran says that the martyrs are alive with God. And that would reflect back with what I said about Abraham and Moses from the lips of Jesus himself. And so from that epistemological perspective, there are many different conclusions that I can form. Now, if I leave that situation behind and pretend for a moment that I'm not going with the Quran, then I have to turn to the Gospels and the histories that are built on the Gospels. Now, if I take the position of the historians, as you're suggesting I would do, and deny that Pilate was reticent, And if I perceive of Pilate as a very brutal individual who wanted Jesus dead, then I would conclude with other historians, with Michael Grant, for example, in his book An Historian's View of the Gospels, and other such historians, that Jesus actually died on the cross, and that he did not physically, bodily resurrect from the dead, that his disciples had an extraordinary vision of him.
Now notice, if you want epistemological confusion, Shabir cannot avoid epistemological confusion because of the overriding demands of his religious beliefs. He can't be consistent at this point either. Because he's now saying, well, if you want me to follow the historians, then the historians have to deny the resurrection. Well, that is, if what you're saying is the historian who approaches the text as a naturalist says, well, I can't demonstrate anything about a supernatural event. All I can tell you is the disciples had this amazing experience, which they claimed was the resurrection. That's fine, but the problem you're now facing is you're buying into the worldview that he's using that says, look, I can't accept a supernatural explanation for this. I can only report to you as a historian that the disciples said X, Y, and Z. I can't take the next step to say that the facts demonstrate that this took place in a historical context. He can't go there. Well, again, as anyone knows, if he's going to approach it that direction, then he needs to apply the same type of critical thinking and non-supernaturalism to everything in the Quran too, which, of course, he's not willing to do. And what did I keep saying in Biola? Inconsistency is the mark of a failed argument.
Disciples wanted so badly to believe that Jesus was alive with God, and so they wanted to believe it so badly that they saw him. Say again?
Paul and James, they didn't want to see him alive. And what about the empty tomb? Empty tomb is, I think, does away with the vision theory.
No, but well, here, Paul...
Very briefly stated, and one of my criticisms of Mike Lycona here is he was just way, 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 way too nice. I mean, let's look at, you know, this cross-examination period. He let Shabir have 80% of it. And when you give the other guy 80% of the time, there's, you know, it doesn't matter what you're saying. The other guy is going to wander all over the landscape and make all sorts of claims you're never going to be able to get back to. You've got to stay in competition here. You know, you got to keep time even. I mean, it needs to be fair, but if you're going to, it's one thing to force yourself on someone else and not let them get a word in edgewise. That's real obvious. But if you just sit back and you won't interrupt at all, so the other person just keeps going on and on and on, that's sort of voluntarily giving that time away, and that's one of the criticisms I would have at that point. But what he just said is exactly right. Visions don't explain the empty tomb. And so you have to come up with all sorts of theories as to what the empty tomb was all about, especially in regards to the interesting fact that Matthew... Remember the one of the very first things that was said in the Talpiot tomb film, in the Jesus family tomb film, was to make reference to Matthew and Matthew's statement about the fact that there were lies going on in reference to the empty tomb. And, of course, they give credence to the lies just uncritically within, I think, the first 30 seconds of that particular film. Well, the fact that Matthew is willing to mention these things, the fact that Matthew is willing to even make reference to the fact that there was at that time people who were denying the resurrection of Christ, and here's the argumentation they used. If there wasn't an empty tomb to worry about, there wouldn't be an apologetic going on. There wouldn't be an argument going on at that point in time. Somebody was having to explain what happened with the empty tomb. The vision theory does not fit with the empty tomb. That's what he was just trying to say there. And he was pointing out, look, you can say that the disciples just really, 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 really wanted to see Jesus. But James, who was an unbeliever, and Paul, who was a persecutor of the church, were not in the situation where they really, really, really wanted to see Jesus. In fact, that was the last thing they really, really, really wanted to see. And so now you have to come up with, well, okay, but we only know about James and Paul post-conversion, and so they had some sort of conversion thing, and then they really, really wanted to see Jesus. But that doesn't explain Paul's conversion at all. I mean, now you're doing all this basically mind reading to try to get around what's going on. Now, he said that very quickly, and unfortunately, I don't think a Muslim listening to his comments would have a clue what he was talking about. Because that's one of the problems with this kind of a context is you can throw so much stuff out there that takes more time to meaningfully respond to than you're ever given within a debate. That's why you have to listen to a debate and you have to use a debate as a starting point, not as a finishing point. Check out the claims that are made. See who is being focused and who's being consistent, so on and so forth.
Paul's vision, as you're saying, as an enemy of Jesus, there's something to say about Paul's vision. Because Paul himself, in his first letter to the Corinthians, he said that that the devil might appear as a bright, shining light, so that many might be deceived. So Paul's testimony that he saw this light cannot be a full and final convincing argument.
Talk about mixing context. yeah, Paul did state that Satan, you know, disguises himself as an angel of light. And what he's saying, of course, is that when Satan is seeking to deceive someone, heretics generally don't show up wearing fake noses and a Bozo the Clown outfit. They dress like us. They talk like us. And the deception is normally subtle, not obvious. To make that connection and say, yeah, but see, he's talked about an angel of light, and Paul saw a light, and therefore Paul could have been deceived, is pretty much on the same level as a lot of the Ali Atai stuff that I've been dealing with in the series on the blog, where you just Paul's writings become silly putty. And you can just pull that stuff apart and like Plato or Silly Putty or whatever you want to do, you just rearrange it as to, you know, however you want to make it look. Don't really think there's a good connection.
Of a physical nature that Jesus physically, bodily rose from the dead. Second, you mentioned James. Now, what has been found in the evolution of the Gospels over time is that starting with...
What has been found in the evolution of the Gospels over time equals what anti-supernaturalistic scholars... who normally contradict one another and have their own particular theories they're wanting to present. Some of them have theorized this, and I'm going to pick and choose from their theories, which are based upon their own thoughts. There's no hard documentation of any of this, but they've theorized this, they've theorized that. It sounds, the way he says it, as if these are the assured results of meaningful, fair scholarship dealing with documented facts. It's not. These are current theories, and some of them have already been exploded. Some of them have already been abandoned by their authors. But they are theories based upon, well, I think that this particular gospel writer or the group of redactors of this particular gospel had this particular perspective they're trying to promote. Now, you can find a dozen other scholars who come up with a different way of doing it. That's the wonder of redaction criticism, is that you can always get published because you don't have to worry about facts. You can pick and choose your facts and string them together as you wish, and that's how it all works. When you say has found, sounds very similar to saying, well, archaeology has found such and such an artifact in history, or science has found this particular gene in the human genome. There's no parallel in the word found there between the various uses I just gave.
With Mark, the family of Jesus had been given a bad rap. It's not like in the Mel Gibson movie where Mary is everywhere there with Jesus by his side and kissing his feet and getting the blood on her lips. In the Gospels, in the Synoptic Gospels, starting with Mark, the family of Jesus looked bad, and so too his disciples. And so, of course...
Now stop just for a moment. What does he mean? Well, actually, basically what's being said is, Mary is shown to have questions. Mary and his brothers come, and he's in the house, and they want him to come out, and they think he's beside himself. And this, quote-unquote, is to make them look bad. No, it doesn't make them look bad. It makes them look human. It makes them look as people who, as John tells us, a consistency with John can't be right. John can't have any historical truth in it, can it? They're unbelievers. They're unbelievers. And as unbelievers, they act like unbelievers. And if you didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, wouldn't he be an embarrassment to you? as a good Jewish person in the first century? How would you like to have people going, hey, isn't that your brother down there by the seaside out there preaching and parables and people are coming to him and he's supposed to be healing them and stuff? That's pretty embarrassing, isn't it? I lost it. And Mark honestly records the fact that they came and they wanted to take him away. And basically, I think they wanted to hide him away. I mean, this is getting embarrassing. You're ruining our reputation in the community. So here you have Mark providing what can only be sound historical information, and we reject that too. See, that's the wonder of redaction criticism, is that, hey, even if on other grounds, this would seem to be really solid stuff, because you're actually giving information that some people might use against you. I mean, some people might say, look, his own family didn't even believe in him. But you're giving that because it's honest history. That would normally be something that a liberal would go, hey, if it's honest history and it would tend to embarrass, then that's probably original. But hey, everything's up for grabs once you've just said, you know what, I'm guilty until proven innocent. In fact, there's no way to prove innocent, so it's just guilty. I'm going to accept what I want, choose what I want, you know, Play-Doh. Super putty, super silly string, whatever. You know, just play with it as I want. And no way around that kind of argumentation.
His brothers don't believe in him. His mother doesn't even seem to understand him in Mark's gospel. So Jesus denounced...
In Mark's gospel? And in Luke's gospel? And in Matthew's gospel? And in John's gospel? It takes time. See, that's what really bothers me about this kind of argumentation. In Mark's gospel, as we're going to make Mark different than Matthew and Luke and John. No. Mary is shown to struggle as she did, and as the early church writers, early church fathers, by the way, hello, down through the centuries, said Mary actually sinned in unbelief and doubt. And of course, they were just private theologians when they said that, because we know the true tradition is that Mary was sinless and never would have done anything like that because Rome tells us.
Sir, denounces her earlier on. And so that is there for a reason, because later Christianity would follow the line of Paul, and because there was tension between Paul and the original disciples of Jesus and the family of Jesus, so Paul was celebrated. And
how do we know these things? What historical evidence do we have of this tension that exists between the original followers of Jesus and Paul? And even somehow we even know the original family of Jesus went with the original followers of Jesus that we don't know anything about. And what evidence do we have of this? I mean, if I were to sit in front of a public audience and say, well, clearly we know that some of the early followers of Muhammad, there was disagreements between them, and that would therefore indicate that this portion of this surah actually came from this group of followers. And excuse me, where do you get that? Well, there's scholars who have said it. You know, I would be rejected instantly for that kind of argumentation, but when it comes to the New Testament, all of a sudden, everything's fair game. And one of the reasons, obviously, is because you have multiple writers in the New Testament, then you can attack this direction, and it's easier when you only have allegedly one writer in the Quran to avoid these kinds of issues. Well, we'll continue with our review of Shabir Ali's comments in the debate with Mike Lycona. Very relevant to what will be coming up in just a few weeks. Want to try at least get this done on The Dividing Line coming up on this Thursday afternoon. See you then. God bless.
Stand.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.